too early. Sorry about that.
Can we do it again?
Waiting for the blue light. Okay. Good morning, everyone. Second take here. Senate Committee on Judiciary is called to order. We have a interesting, somewhat full schedule today. It's public hearings and work sessions on two bills, and then some work sessions, and we have members, I believe Senate Bill 220 has been taken off of the agenda today because LC has noticed an issue on the drafting, and so they need to clarify or clean that up. So, Councilor, I'm going to start at the top.
All right.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 488. And if you can give us an overview.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 488 requires a circuit court judge to allow attorney to appear by telephone if evidence will not be submitted and the attorney's office is more than 50 miles away from the hearing site. That's all I have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Brian, if you'll come on up, and Bruce Miller, if you'll come up. And Brian, since this is a bill that was introduced on your behalf, why don't you go ahead and start off?
Good morning, Senators. My name is Brian Cox. I'm a practicing attorney, have been for almost 20 years. My practice focuses quite a bit on civil and criminal litigation, and I appear in every county throughout Oregon. I propose this bill to try to accomplish two things, and I appreciate Senator Prozanski's sponsoring it and putting it forward for consideration. The two primary goals of this bill is designed to save money and decrease the environmental impact of the court operation. The money savings that can be created by this bill are probably best described by example. I was allowed to appear in two courts yesterday by telephone. By doing that, I calculated my environmental savings to be over 500 miles of non-driving yesterday by myself or somebody else, and I calculated my client savings to be over $1,000. That's two court appearances on by one lawyer in one day. On top of that, I believe there's, I surmise there's some incremental savings to the court operation itself for every staff minute or security minute that's reduced by the people who don't need to be in that courthouse. This, I pass this bill out, or the text of this bill out, onto a couple of listservs, and without, and these are attorney listservs, and without exception, every single person who responded supported this bill. There was two suggestions made to modify the text of the bill as it exists, and one of the suggestions was lower the limit to 25 miles, and one of the suggestions is we're in the 21st century, schedule everything you can schedule by telephone that can be done that way, with the idea that every single time we do that, we have an environmental savings and a cost savings to our clients and to the taxpayers of Oregon. It's hard to imagine what downside there is to this, and you might ask the question, why do we need it? It makes so much sense. Why aren't the courts letting us do that? And there seems to be two prior impediments to that, and one's a practical one and one's an institutional one. And the practical one seems to be that in some cases, the turnaround time it takes to file a motion for permission to appear by court versus notifying the court that you're going to appear by telephone and them having to accommodate that often is not long enough to make that request, or you're required to make a personal appearance to ask to be able to make a telephone appearance. And Multnomah County is a perfect example of that approach to this. The institutional problem is, quite honestly, there's a lot of judges who won't do it if they don't have to. And the UTCR that requires judges to grant oral argument by telephone when a counsel asks for it on motions works. We get it. It's virtually never denied. And when it's denied for reasons that we can all at least identify and make sense of. And every court can do it. So every hurdle that a court says they can't meet is met under the current UTCR structure for motions. I had a chance to speak with Mr. Miller about this, and he suggested that maybe the better change would be to the UTCR versus to the statute. My goal in proposing this legislation, however it's implemented, is to change the default answer from no to yes in these situations.
All right, thank you. And Mr. Miller, why don't you go ahead?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm senior staff counsel in the Office of the State Court Administrator. One point I'd like to address before we get going is the notion that every hearing should by default be done by telephone. That's actually a concept that was suggested to the Uniform Trial Court Rules Committee last fall. They are in the process of looking at that, but they preliminarily disapproved that notion because a number of our courts cannot accommodate the volume of telephone calls that would require for every hearing, every motion. And it's much more helpful to the court if we follow what's in the UTCR already for motions, which is when a party wants it, they ask for it. Oftentimes parties don't want it, and so then you would have to have an opt-out provision if you said everything goes by phone. Nonetheless, that's not the proposal before you today. The proposal today is, I think, to broaden what's already in the UTCR to include things other than motions that are not evidentiary hearings. There are a couple ways we can approach that. There are actually two UTCRs on this, 4.050, which is criminal motions. I don't think that's what we're talking about here. And there's 5.050, which deals with civil motions. And from talking with Mr. Cox, I believe we're discussing the civil arena here, and so that's what I'll focus on. One approach would be to amend 5.050 to say not only motions, but motions and other non-evidentiary hearings. The things that the court needs in that instance and what is accommodated in the rule is notice that a party wants this, and the party is supposed to supply the names of all the other parties and their phone numbers, and the requesting party is supposed to initiate the call and bear the expense of the call. Those are all things that we need to make this work, and I think if we adjusted the rule there, then we could make it work. If the committee isn't inclined to go that direction, then perhaps we could amend the bill to put in the same requirements that we have in rule. We have more flexibility with the rule. We can get on that, but those are the options that I see for dealing with this.
Thank you, Bruce. Questions for either panelist? Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Chair. Is there some reason in the rulemaking process you can't do what you just said?
No reason. We can do it. It was never brought to us. If the Uniform Trial Court Rules Committee accepts recommendations for change from any source, we have a one-year cycle. In the fall, we consider new recommendations. We then send them out for public comment. In the spring, the committee meets again, makes their final recommendations to the Chief Justice, and then the Chief Justice implements them. And they go into effect on August 1 each year, each change.
All right. So, follow up on that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. I guess what I'm saying, you have Oregon administrative rules. Generally, we pass a statute and your department makes a rule to implement it. Couldn't, if we pass this, your department make a rule to implement what you just explained?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, yes, we could. If we're going to do that, I would like an amendment, or it might be helpful to amend the rule to say that something to the effect of procedures and requirements may be established by state court rule for a party who wishes to make an appearance as authorized by Section 1. That way it's very clear in the statute that the statute, you know, refers to there's going to be more procedure here. You don't just get to assume you're going to have a telephone hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Omichi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe this is a question for counsel. Is this Senate Bill 488 intended to amend the Uniform Trial Court Rules? It doesn't say where it's what it's amending.
Senator Bonamici, I'm not sure exactly where this would go. I know the Uniform Trial Court Rules are done by the Chief Justice, right. So we don't need to actually do a statute to affect those. So Mr. Miller told me that if the committee wants to go this direction, that he could just take that to the Chief Justice and go ahead and work on that without a statute change.
Thank you for clarification.
I want to, Bruce, if you can clarify for me, what I understand is that if this went through the normal process of having someone submit it as a recommendation, It takes about a year for it to go through that process, meaning you make the suggestion up until sometime into the fall. Then it's reviewed, sent out for public comment. Spring comes around, final decisions are made, and then the Chief Justice agrees with what the committee has come up with. Then it's implemented in August of that year.
Mr. Chair, that's the normal cycle. On the other hand, the Chief Justice has the ability to adopt rules or changes to the rules out of cycle. So, for instance, if this were something that the committee felt strongly about and wanted a change in the rule, I could take it to the Chief Justice and say, perhaps we need to adopt this or amend this out of cycle. We could work with Mr. Cox, try to get the rule into the position that would be helpful to address his issue. And we could do it more quickly. Now, having said that, even when we make changes out of cycle, occasionally we have to do them so quickly that we don't allow public comment on them. I'm the Uniform Trial Court Rules reporter. My personal preference is that we should always try to allow some public comment on it. So my preference in that role would be to, even if we amended it out of cycle, would be to send it out for public comment first, allow a few weeks for comment, and then the Chief Justice has some feedback as he makes his final decision on it.
Okay. So let me follow up on a couple of things I want to put on the record. It's my understanding in the federal court system, this type of practice is more common than not as to telephone conferences and hearings. Is that correct understanding on my part?
Mr. Chair, I don't have any knowledge of that.
That's been my experience. Between e-filing and telephone appearances, it's rare to find live bodies at the courthouse anymore, the federal courthouse.
All right. And the other thing is, it seems to me that we're looking at a means of actually making the process a little bit more efficient by having this, so you don't have people traveling. And I would assume that for the court, it would make it more accommodating in the period, in the sense as long as all the rules are intact, everyone knows how it's going to be done, who's responsible for the cost, which may actually be some savings to the court.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure about the savings because there still tends to be a lot of staff work that has to do to coordinate these things. But I think the key element is to have the parties initiate and bear cost. And I do worry about the other issue that I raised at the beginning, which is a huge volume. If we made this the default for everyone, would really cripple a number of our courthouses. They just don't have the technology in place for it. But the motions element and the rules works, and I think that we can make this work in the same way.
Okay. So is there any other questions? If not, what I'm going to ask, if you two could work together, I would like to have, let's say, a comfort check with the Chief Justice as to this going in effect. If this was going to be passed as a bill, the way it's currently drafted, it would not go into effect until January 1 of next year. And so that's, I would assume, would be ample time to be able to make the transition, get public hearing, and maybe even have a uniform trial rule in place even before that date, but still give some flexibility?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
All right, so at this time, we can't move the bill even if we wanted to. I think there's some work that needs to be done, plus we don't have a fiscal. So what I'm going to do is go ahead and first ask if there's anyone else here that wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 488. Not seeing anyone, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing with the understanding that the parties will kind of work together and maybe report back to us whether we think we can move this in or really need to move it at this point as a change in the statute or an addition to the statutes, or whether this can just be done through the rule process.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'll report back to you and let you know what we've come to, whether we agree, disagree, and whether you need to move the bill or we'll do it some other way.
And if we are looking at moving the bill, then I am looking for suggestions as to modifying it to make certain it works within the process that the court works with.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Anything else?
Thank you.
Thank you. We're now going to open up our next public hearing. This is on 2353A. And counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2353A limits the authority of shareholders of a publicly traded corporation to call a special meeting. It defines publicly traded corporation. It applies to special meetings on or after the effective date. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and no amendment. And the measure history is written on your SMS. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. And I have what looks like is going to be a panel of Chris Hall and Andy Morrill, and then we'll come back with two other people that are signed up.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Hall. I'm here in support of House Bill 2353. I'm a partner at the law firm Perkins Coie. I'm a member of the Oregon State Bar Business Law Section Executive Committee and chair of its legislative committee. However, I'm not here representing the bar, positions of the bar today. House Bill 2353 is meant to provide Oregon public companies the ability to rationally negotiate terms of buyout offers and to remove from management potentially costly distractions from running a business. It puts Oregon public companies in the same place that most investors and companies nationally expect, matching Delaware law. Backing up a second, the bill provides that shareholders of a public company may only call a special meeting if authorized by the articles or bylaws. Currently, Oregon law requires special meetings to be called if shareholders are holding 10% or in some cases up to 25% of the shares. Practically, electing directors, corporate governance, activist shareholder proposals, minority shareholder rights, if you will, are done at annual meetings. It's rare for shareholders of a public company to call a special meeting. It's very expensive. The stakes are high. So they really don't do it for anything other than to try to force a hostile takeover. In fact, I polled my partners in my firm, and they're not aware of any time that shareholders have tried to call a special meeting outside that context. So depending on a company's anti-takeover protections, at a special meeting, an acquirer can take over an Oregon public company's board of directors with as little as 10 days' notice without any discussion or negotiation with the company. With downward swings and financial markets like we're seeing now, Oregon public companies may be forced to sell, mostly get firms who have headquarters outside of Oregon. Oregon has already adopted anti-takeover statutes, which are really meant to provide Oregon companies the opportunity to manage change of control and maximize sales prices. House Bill 2353 just eliminates this vulnerability created by shareholders being able to call a special meeting. In addition, the amendment limits potential cost management distractions associated with the special meeting. And my own experience is I did represent a company who was subject to a hostile takeover, and the shareholders did call a special meeting. The anti-takeover protection of the company was good, so they couldn't actually do anything at the end of the meeting other than get an advisory vote. In other words, the shareholders advising the company they should take the offer. It cost the company hundreds of thousands of dollars, mostly in lawyer's fees, thank you. And so it was just a huge distraction, huge cost, but didn't really provide, you know, much purpose other than just kind of to harass the company. However, I'd like to point out that shareholders will continue to have all rights to affect corporate governance at an annual meeting. And if shareholders want to be able to call special meetings, they can amend the bylaws of the company so that they continue, if they find that right important, they can amend the bylaws to make sure they continue to have that right. So I urge the committee to vote in favor of House Bill 2353.
Mr. Morrow.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Andy Morrow. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland with Foster Pepper. I have been past chair of the Business Law Section Executive Committee and legislative chair of that section for the bar. I'm appearing today just speaking for myself. But I have been involved in the Business Corporation Act and its revision since 1985. To reiterate what Mr. Hall has already said, this bill is designed to keep special meetings from being used as a tool against public companies. It, as he noted, is an expensive and time-consuming process, a distraction from the operation of the company.
and generally accomplishes little or nothing. But it becomes a tool in trying to manipulate a company. And I would point out that this bill does make the distinction between public and private companies, and these changes apply to the public company context. I've had the experience of working with a company that was subject to attack by an investor from outside, basically was looking for an increase in value by creating activity in the stock, not so much looking really to improve the business of the company, but a way to make the use of the investment. And this is one of the tools that gets used by those kinds of investors in trying to take over a company and just create distraction. So I would urge the committee to move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, gentlemen. Questions? Senator Romichi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hall, you mentioned that under the bill, it still allows shareholders to demand a special meeting according to the bylaws. So how would that differ from the existing provisions?
Chair, Senator Romichi. So currently, the law requires, regardless of the bylaws, that shareholders own at least 10% of shares unless the articles provide up to 25%, can call a special meeting. So that's just the minimum that the bylaws could say, if you will. When I say the shareholders can still require it, the default is that if your bylaws and articles don't say anything about special meetings, then the shareholders can't call a special meeting. If shareholders want to say, nonetheless, I want to call a special meeting, the next annual meeting comes up, they propose a bylaw amendment, which they have a right to do, and the bylaw amendment will say shareholders having 10%, 20%, whatever it is they feel like, have a right to call a special meeting. That's in the bylaws, and from then on, the company is going to have to comply with that.
Thank you. And a follow-up?
Yes.
The existing provision, the 10% default with up to 25%, is from the Model Business Corporations Act?
Yes,
is that correct? Thank you. That's
all. Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. Gentlemen, how would this proposed amendment to the current law restrict shareholders from calling a special meeting to address mismanagement, malfeasance, impending bankruptcy in a corporation that does not have a clause allowing a special meeting to be called? I mean, I assume there's a lot of these corporations out here who do not have that clause in their articles of incorporation or their bylaws. And what would be, if we were to pass this, what would protect those companies that don't have any restriction? It would protect their shareholders from in the next year, or between now and the next meeting, in this economic time of economic turmoil. I mean, what would protect them?
Chair, Senator, what's that? I would say, I guess, first thing I want to know, and maybe this is somewhat of an aside, that most companies' bylaws now will follow whatever the statute is. It's just the way people set up their bylaws. So what you're going to find is that probably every company already has now the ability for shareholders to call a special meeting in their articles or bylaws. So what companies will need to do to have shareholders not be able to call a special meeting now is actually amend their bylaws to take an affirmative action. So to take that, move that right away, and then the shareholders would have to, at the meeting, pull it back again. So it's not like all of a sudden shareholders are not going to have a right across the board to call special meetings. But to get to more, I think, what the real substance of your question is, shareholders, we just don't find shareholders calling special meetings because of corporate malfeasance. There's little shareholders can actually do outside of lawsuits, which they can do anytime anyways, other than replace the board of directors. And you just don't see special shareholder meetings called for that purpose. if they don't like what's happening with the corporation, they don't like the directors, they don't like some of the corporate governance procedures. There's a lot of shareholder proposals that go on out there where they're trying to improve the corporate governance and stop some of the bad things we've been reading about in the paper. Those happen at the annual meeting. It's just rare for that to happen at a special meeting. It's very expensive to call a special meeting. The company already sends out proxy materials. They send out a bunch of information in the annual meeting. And so what shareholders do is they hook up on that, and they can actually piggyback off what the company already is doing to have their proposals in, to change the board of directors, and to do other things. And that's where that really takes place. So I don't believe you're really taking something away from shareholders, because it's something that they don't exercise anyways.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, the other thing, distinction that it's important to make here is between the public and private company. The context where the kind of situation that you're talking about that tends to get done through a special meeting would be in the private company context, not a public company. As Mr. Hall pointed out, that process is typically done by litigation or by changes that are done at the annual meeting.
You may.
I just have a follow-up, because I want to follow up on Senator Witz's question. I know, Mr. Hall, you said that the shareholders don't use it anyway, but if this bill were in effect, they'd have to wait until the annual meeting, then try to amend the bylaws, and then they'd have the right to call a special meeting. Is that correct?
Correct.
And then one more follow-up question, if I may, Mr.
Right.
Chair. So the shareholders who are invested in public companies now invested with the Model Business Corporation Act provisions in effect. So this bill would change that to existing investors. Is that correct?
Chair Senator, that is correct. I mean, I would like to point out, however, I mean, if you think about public shareholders and their investing and whether they know what Oregon law is on this case, Delaware, as we know, is by far the substantial place where people incorporate for public companies. And if there is any expectation that they have, unless they actually investigated Oregon law, then they would have gotten what Delaware has, which is the model. It's not exactly Delaware's law, but the theme is the same as Delaware. So they're just getting the same thing they'd get in Delaware, so what they get in most companies. So I'm not sure that their expectations would be unfulfilled, if you will.
Thank you.
All right. And I guess I want to just get some clarification. Chris, what I heard you say is that at this point, the bylaws that corporations have pretty well establish the right for these special meetings and such. And if that's the case, by passing this legislation, all we're doing is saying if a corporation is incorporated under the state of Oregon laws, that this is what would be required. But because the bylaws that are existing in a corporation, they're still going to be controlling until the shareholders at an annual meeting makes that change?
Yeah, that's correct.
If the bylaws can be amended typically by the board of directors. So the board of directors, if this statute were in effect, could make the change and eliminate the ability to call a special meeting between annual meetings.
Okay, so the board of directors could make that call. And if they made that call, then we would be what the bill provides for until an annual meeting at that time. If the shareholders say, wait a second, we want to still have the ability to do the special meetings, then they would propose a change in the bylaws. And
That's
you would
correct.
Assume that the board of directors would be following whatever the shareholders are wanting. I assume that 3 months later, if the board of directors wanted to change it back, there's nothing to stop them from doing that.
Mr. Chair, once the
bylaws
were
changed,
amended,
that's right.
Yeah, they will.
Yeah. Okay, I stand corrected. Any other questions, comments? Thank you all very much. All right, the last two people I have signed up is Dean Freed and Tom Gallagher.
Chairman Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Dean Freed. I'm general counsel at Metagraphics Corporation. I'd like to make sure the committee is aware that this risk is not just theoretical. Last summer, a large California software company called Cadence Design Systems made a hostile takeover attempt on Metagraphics. They made very clear to our shareholders that their intent was to call a special meeting before the end of the summer and either remove our existing board or add enough new directors that Metagraphics would no longer be an independent entity. Mentor Management is quite confident that this would have happened had the deal gone through. We felt very, very lucky that Cadence was unable to complete its offer because it had an announcement of some very poor earnings and was forced to withdraw the offer because it was unable to get financing based on its cash flow. To give you a little bit of information about Mentor Graphics, we're a $800 million company selling software to design electronics based in Wilsonville. We've got about 1,000 employees in Wilsonville. We were incorporated in Oregon in 1981 and are very proudly an Oregon company. And we believe internally that if the acquisition had occurred, that we would have certainly lost 300 to 400 high-paying jobs in the Wilsonville area, and it would have been very difficult for those people to find new jobs in Oregon. These are people like IT professionals, lawyers, HR, operations. One other point I'd like to mention is that this is Mentor is not the only company. Tektronix also had a similar experience with George Soros in the 90s, where the general counsel has told me, the former general counsel of Tektronix, that if the New York lawyers that were representing George Soros had known about the provision of Oregon law that allowed the calling of a special shareholder meeting on such short notice, that they wouldn't have had time to come to an agreement with Soros and his team that allowed Tektronix to remain independent. Thank you.
Thank you. Tom?
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing the Portland Business Alliance. Over 1,300 members in Washington, Multnomah, Clackamas, Yamhill, and Clark County. Our policy committee has looked at this bill, and we have many, if not most, of the publicly traded companies inside of our area, and they're very supportive of this bill. Anything that encourages corporations to settle in Oregon, to stay in Oregon, and to keep their contacts basically here in Oregon is very helpful to the general business climate. So we're very supportive of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel?
Just a quick one. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dean, do you know that in the Tektronix example that you gave, that was before the Model Business Corporations Act was amended to increase the percentage that could be up to 25%? Is that
correct, Senator?
Fairly recent. So it was only 10% could call a shareholder meeting at that time?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2353?
Oh, before you gaveled on, I just...
We got someone else.
Oh, okay.
I'm Jay Waldron. I'm an attorney with Schwabe Williamson and Wyatt, and I simply wanted to respond to three questions that were asked. The first question was regarding the Model Act. I wanted to make it clear to the committee that this is like many model acts within the law, that there is a basic model act and it has been modified in every state, and there really isn't any state that has the exact provisions of the model act. Each state tailors the model act to meet its own needs. On the question about would shareholders be deprived of the ability to question a corporation that wasn't behaving properly, I think it was partially answered. That there are, as we all know, a proliferation of shareholder lawsuits, and that is the preferred vehicle to address what companies are doing, not a special meeting. The primary purpose of a special meeting is sort of documented in the literature and referred to by people that have appeared before you this morning, is really to threaten the board of directors with removal unless they pay attention to the short-term stock price. So it's the primary purpose of this bill is to enable companies like Mentor and lots of the other publicly owned companies in Oregon, like Columbia or Standard Insurance or ESCO to have their board of directors focus on long-term and what's best for the company and the employees and not focus on the short-term stock price. And then finally, there was a question about what existing investor expectation is, and the vast majority of large publicly owned companies and the vast majority of companies that are retained within mutual funds are companies that are incorporated in Delaware. And this, in a sense, mirrors Delaware law. And I think this would meet the expectations of companies. I think the bottom line is there really isn't any discernible harm to shareholders, but it is an extra help in Oregon retaining corporations that are incorporated here, in retaining jobs, and in keeping board of directors for publicly owned companies in Oregon focused on the long-term health of the company, not the short-term share price. Thank you.
Mr. Waldron, before you leave, I just want to make certain I have this correct. The proposal that's in this House Bill 2353, if it was adopted, would be closely similar to what is currently in Delaware's corporation?
That is correct.
All right, thank you. Other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Baldwin, how does it compare to other states other than Delaware, for example, states in our region?
I believe, and this is from memory, that Washington has a 40% rule. I believe Nevada, this is similar to, Nevada, where increasingly corporations are starting to incorporate. I don't know what California is.
Thank you.
Any other comments, questions? Thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who'd like to give testimony today on House Bill 2353?
No, but Mr. Chair, can I just make a statement to avoid appearance of impropriety that Chris Hall is a law partner of my husband's and Dean Freed was my law school classmate. So just to get that on the record. So
okay.
Lawyers in the House or something like that?
Yeah.
And with that, we will close the public hearing on 2353. And colleagues, at this point, that takes care of our public hearings. We are going to move into work sessions regarding these various bills, unless someone wants to tell me that they're still contemplating anything at this point. If not, then I'm going to go ahead and open up the work session on the first one, which is Senate Bill 280. And counsel, remind us what 280 is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 280 is the cockfighting bill Senator Courtney brought to the committee. And it has no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact. That was an issue at the hearing. And we heard it on February 12th, and there is no amendment.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 280 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist has moved House Senate Bill 280 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I just assume that the carrier or the sponsor will want to carry it, so we won't have to.
Any other discussions? Any objection? Senator Boquist, I'm sorry to let you know, but Mr. President has asked that you be the carrier on this bill.
I'd be delighted, Mr. Chair.
So according to my survival, Senator Boquist will be the carrier at President Courtney's request. Thank you, Senator.
That last session.
Oh, did he?
That was in the House, wasn't it?
All right. So that closes that session. We're open the public the work session on our next bill, which is 398.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 398 is the abandonment of equines bill. We heard it on February 12th as well. It does have a dash one amendment, and it changes the word continued care to minimum care, which is defined in another statute. There is no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact on this as well.
All right. Thank you. And let's see. First I'm going to do is ask if there's a motion on 398. I'm going to come back to 280 in a minute.
We need an amendment motion, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I move the dash one into Senate Bill 398, and I'll speak to the motion.
All right. Senator Boquist moves the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 398. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Just for the other thing it does do is it adds equine into another portion of the law, which
in my review of it, fixes the issue of having horses and cattle at large, which are typically open range issues, which was raised, I think, if I recall correctly, by the Farm Bureau, probably
that's
the
correct.
And the Rangers.
So it was.
This is the fix that everybody wanted, Mr. Chair.
That's right. And that's just adding the minimum care in and taking out the other part that was in the existing statute, which has been and is current law. Any other discussion? Senator Wessett?
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. There's been quite a bit of concern among some of the horse breeding industry that this bill would change the designation of a horse to a domestic animal. And I want to read something in the record here, which is an LC opinion from Josh Nasby to counteract that concern.
All right, that's fine.
You have asked this office whether Senate Bill 398 alters the current distinction between domestic animals and livestock for the purposes of the animal offenses described in ORS 167.310 to 167.351. The answer is no. The only change to Oregon law made by SB 398 is to include equines in the case in the class of animals for which a person may be convicted of an animal abandonment under ORS 167.340. ORS 167.310 defines domestic animal for the purpose of ORS 167.310 to 167.351 as an animal other than livestock that is owned and possessed by a person. This definition divides animals into two categories. Livestock is defined in ORS 609.125 and all other animals. Livestock is in turn defined to mean horses, mules, jackasses, cattle. Nothing in Senate Bill 398 alters those two definitions. Under current law, the crime of animal abandonment applies only to domestic animals. Section 1 of Senate Bill 398 amends ORS 167.340 to include equines. Thus, if Senate Bill 398 becomes law, a person could be convicted of abandoning a domestic animal or an equine. Section 2 of Senate Bill 398 amends ORS 167.310 to define equine as a horse, pony, donkey, mule, guinea, or zebra. Because this term is not currently used in ORS 167.310 to 167.351, Senate Bill 398 becomes law. The sole use of the term in the series will be in the statute defining the crime of animal abandonment. Thus, while Senate Bill 398 amends the crime of animal abandonment to include the abandonment of equines, the bill does not modify current law with regard to the distinction made between domestic animals and livestock under ORS 167.310 to 167.351.
Right, thank you. And I'm going to go ahead and just put on the record as well. If we look at the bill as it's drafted on line 15 on page 1, it has a definition for domestic animal. And in reading across there, it means any animal. Then there's a comma that says other than livestock. With the dash 1 amendments, it will include or equines right after livestock and then with another comma that is owned or possessed by a person. So clearly, a domestic animal is not livestock or equines. Any other statements we need to put on the record before we move forward? All right, so that's we have the motion before us regarding the dash ones. Is there any other discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 398 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 398, as amended by the dash 1 amendments, to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Ordered. Senator Wessett, would you be okay? If not, I'll take Senator Wessett will be our carry on that. And I'm going to go ahead and close the work session on that. Now, I do want to make a statement here. Senator Dingfelder is out this morning. She's stuck in district, and so she will be shown as excused on all of her votes today. That includes the one that we've the two that we've taken, 280 and 398. And we're going to open a work session now on Senate Bill 464.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 464 was the Truth in Music bill we heard on February 18th. It prohibits the use or attempted use of the name of a recording group for advertising live performance if a member is not performing in that group. We did have a question from Senator Whitsett at that meeting whether that would, because Indian casinos were one of the areas that this was a problem, whether this bill would actually reach to Indian casinos. And we have Ivanovic from the Department of Justice said, yes, it does, with some caveats. There is no amendment, and there's no revenue impact or fiscal impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Chair, I move SB 464 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 464 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Senator
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the sponsor of the bill. I saw in the newspaper in Portland that Sha Na Na is appearing at one of the casinos in Oregon, and I wonder if that's the real Sha Na Na and if the Bowser is actually going to be there or if that's an imposter group.
We're working on that as we speak. We're tracking that down. We have our music beagles out there snooping to find out what the answer is, and hopefully I'll have that answer before this bill makes it to the floor. Any other questions or comments? Any objection to the motion? So ordered, and the chair will carry this one. And that brings us to closing this work session on Senate Bill 464, opening a work session on Senate Bill 218.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 218 is from the Department of Justice. This one we heard on February 4th. It increased the eligibility and awards for crime victims compensation. At that hearing, we had a Dash 1 amendment that talked about out-of-country travel. The Dash 1 amendment has since been removed from the bill, so it's just the regular bill. There's no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 218 to the floor without amendments.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 218 as drafted to the floor with due pass recommendation. Is there any question or discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And let's see.
214.
Yeah, I'm looking at 218 to see, and 214. I'll tell you what, the chair will go ahead and carry this one as well.
So just to clarify, we're not discussing the amendments.
No. It's actually, we've just passed the bill.
Right.
Well, it's just 218.
There is no amendments.
No amendments. Yeah,
there are no amendments.
I understand.
Okay.
Doesn't exist.
All right, so we're closing the work session on 218, and we're opening up our last work session for today on Senate Bill 214. No.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 214 is also from the Attorney General. This had to do with the Oregon's Tobacco Master Settlement complementary legislation, and it's about subpoenaing records of tobacco product distributors and manufacturers. It has no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact, has a Dash 2 amendment, so it makes sure that the bill covers all distributors of tobacco products, both cigarette and roll your own, not only those distributors who distribute only cigarettes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendment into SB 214.
Senator Boquist moves the Dash 2 into Senate Bill 214. Any discussion? Senator Wissett.
Yeah, I'm struggling with the need for this bill. In reviewing the statute 323.538.4 sub A, a purchaser in possession of tobacco products who is unable to present a sales invoice that meets the requirements of this section is presumed to be in possession of tobacco products for which the tax imposes under ORS 323500 to 323645 has not been paid. And in sub B, in the case of a purchaser in possession of untaxed tobacco products, the tax is due immediately upon a penalty, with a penalty of 100% of the tax due, and so forth. I'm struggling. What are we doing with this bill? Maybe I'm missing the point.
My understanding is the bill actually allows for bills, records that are kept regarding cigarette sales and those that are involved in the distribution to be compelled to be turned over for review by the Attorney General. And so my understanding, this is basically a bill that will ensure that records that are kept by distributors are in compliance with the subpoena request from the Attorney General. And let's see, I've got two people here from the Attorney General's office if we want to bring them forward and get clarification and make sure I'm correct on that. Why don't y'all come on up?
I apologize. I didn't hear the last thing you said, but I wanted to clarify what we're doing in the bill is 323 that you're speaking.
I need you to just first ID yourself.
I apologize. My name is Lisa Edlin. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Department of Justice. Senator Whitsett, Chapter 323 deals with the Department of Revenue and cigarette taxes, and Chapter 180 actually deals with complementary legislation and the MSA and our enforcement of requirements related to the MSA from the Department of Justice. So they're actually two separate items.
Okay. All right. Any other questions, comments? All right. If not, thank you very much for coming forward. Is there any? Okay, fine. I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to close the work session on this bill. I understand that maybe there's some other things that need to be looked at.
No, not this one.
Oh.
Sorry.
All right. Now, I'm not closing the work session on this one. All right. So the dash twos are before us. Any objection? So order.
Mr. Chair, move SB 214 to the floor with a due pass, and then I'll speak to my motion.
All right. Senator Boquist moves the passage of Senate Bill 214 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation to your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, the bill really does two things in my light, and I'm going to stretch back to my Revenue Committee work group days. The first thing it does, which is the obvious and original one, which means that they're supposed to provide the report, and if they don't, we can now force them. That's issue one. The second issue has to do with the affixing of other tobacco products, and that means that there are just generally, in my understanding of in revenue days, there's tobacco and there's not tobacco. There's two types of tobacco groups. There's other tobacco products, and then there's the regular people that are in the master tobacco settlement. Looking at the amendment, it seems like it just puts them back into one category, which means we now have the ability to reach in to people who are supposed to be paying taxes and ensure they're providing us the correct data, so on and so forth like that. So I'm quite supportive of this. It's a backdoor deal to something that I failed to do in my first legislative session, and I'd be delighted to carry it.
All righty. Any other comments or discussion? Not hearing anything? Those are an objection to the motion. Please let me know. If not, the so order goes to the floor. We would give this President Courtney, but since Senator Boquist wants it, he'll get it. All right. So the intention at this point is I'm going to be closing the today's work out regarding 2353. There is some discussions that are ongoing, and wanted to give everyone an opportunity to have time before we moved it. I understand that we do have all the documentation. And so we'll be hopefully having this back on the schedule for a work session in a very short period of time. So with that, we're close the Senate Judiciary Committee for today, and we're set to be here tomorrow at 8:30. Thank you.